Many dams and rivers have been taken down in Pennsylvania. Now, the water and wildlife can go with the flow.
Since the dam has been removed, it's the first time I've ever seen fish here, so it was really encouraging.
I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. Today on our program, taking down dams, plus a contentious endangered species bill and the latest shale news. All this and more is coming your way. Please stay tuned. A Pennsylvania House bill that would give natural gas companies and home builders more say in wildlife conservation passed in committee this week, but the bill faces opposition from many environment and sportsmen's groups, in part because it could cost the Commonwealth $27 million in federal funds. It's been nearly 40 years since Pennsylvania's been using its Endangered Species Act to try to save plants, animals, and fish from extinction. The Game Commission and the Fish and Boat Commission have historically been in charge of deciding which species are officially at risk. The bill just approved by a House committee would take that job out of their hands. Instead, the state legislature and a review panel appointed by the legislature and the governor would decide which species should be considered endangered or threatened. Republican State Representative Jeff Pyle of Armstrong County sponsored the bill. He's clear about its intent. He wants the process to be more business friendly.
If you go back and you look at the Game Commission and Fish and Boats Charter, they are not allowed to make any decisions based on economic reasons. But I think in today's economy and with jobless figures the way they are, it has to be considered. There's a balance to everything.
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported that the Marcellus Shale Coalition, Associated Petroleum Industries of Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania Oil and Gas Association are all supporting the bill. But opponents of the bill say industry and politicians shouldn't be making scientific decisions.
This is what the industries want. They want the authority removed from the Fish and Boat Commission and from the Game Commission. And they want it now to be under a political control.
That's Laura Jackson. She's a conservationist from Bedford County who opposes the changes. She's joined by the directors of the Fish and Boat Commission, the Game Commission, the Sierra Club of Pennsylvania, and other environment and outdoors groups. There are concerns that the bill could cost Pennsylvania $27 million in federal funds if it becomes law. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service requires that agencies have independent authority over species designations. Lawmakers crafted an amendment to the bill in an effort to avoid this loss. The act is scheduled for a vote by the full House this week and will then move to the Senate. Pennsylvania Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Mary Wilson contributed reporting on this from Harrisburg. This is the Allegheny Front. One species that's not endangered but could be susceptible to climate change is white-tailed deer. And big game is a big deal in Pennsylvania. With more than 750,000 hunters of the state's white-tailed deer and bear populations going out into the woods every year. That's why a new report from the National Wildlife Federation, which details climate change threats to big game herds across the country, is recommending that hunters and others take steps to help sustain wildlife as temperatures rise. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsapple has more.
Taxes from hunting equipment and supplies have brought $300 million to Pennsylvania since the Pittman-Robertson Act earmarked those funds for wildlife conservation in 1937. The money's helped restore and manage deer and wildlife populations, which were decimated in the early 20th century. Scientists and conservationists worry that climate change will undo all of that work. The National Wildlife Federation report says species across the country, from moose to bighorn sheep, are affected by climate change. In Pennsylvania, warming temperatures mean bears might sleep less. As a result, they'll be hungrier and more likely to interact with humans and be killed in accidents, leaving orphaned cubs. While white-tailed deer may thrive in warmer temperatures, pathogens which infect deer are on the rise as a result of climate change. An increasing number of deer are suffering from what's known as hemorrhagic disease. It's more common in the southeastern United States and has been tracked in deer populations over the last 33 years. John Fisher, adjunct professor of pathology and director of the Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study at the University of Georgia, says there's been a change in its range.
What we believe we are seeing is a spread to the north and increasing severity of this disease to the north over time. And this has been especially apparent over about the last 10 to 15 years.
The disease, which can be fatal, is transmitted by insects, which deer are exposed to in unseasonably warm weather. The report offers some solutions, like reducing fossil fuel use and creating game conservation plans that account for climate change. And reaching out to hunters about climate change, asking them to lobby for fewer hunting licenses or even track weather-related patterns in wildlife. The report's author, Doug Inkley, says regardless of the conservative reputation of hunters, when it comes to climate change, their politics don't override their experience.
And especially it's the hunters that are getting a little gray in the beard to say, you know, my gosh, I used to have to go out in my winter clothing and I'd freeze to death hunting deer, and now I'm swatting mosquitoes. When they think about it from their own perspective, they get it.
For the Allegheny Front, I'm Kara Holsapple.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett this week borrowed a phrase or two from environmentalists as he took a swipe at critics who say he's been exaggerating the economic benefits of the shale industry. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more on what Corbett had to say during a visit to Pittsburgh.
Corbett was at the David L. Lawrence Convention Center this week at a shale drilling convention. He was promoting his signature economic policy as governor, the development of the Marcellus Shale into the nation's largest gas field. Corbett is running for re-election next year, and his poll numbers aren't very good. One bright spot, though, for him, shale development has either created or helped make more secure 200,000 jobs in the state.
That number, of course, seems to bother some out there.
The governor was referring to economic professors who said many of those jobs are only indirectly related to the shale industry and would exist regardless of the shale boom. The 200,000 number comes from a state jobs report. The same report says direct jobs in the industry are really around 30,000. Corbett floated a new name for people who questioned the jobs impact of shale. He called them economic development deniers.
Opponents are finding a few economists who are willing to say that the 20 or 30,000 jobs held directly in the industry here in Pennsylvania really don't mean so much.
He said denying the benefits of shale means overlooking an inconvenient truth. That's a nod to Al Gore's environmental film about climate change. Out on the convention floor, some of those 200,000 people working in industries related to drilling were hustling for more business. Richard Cunningham of Millennium Torque and Tensioning showed off one of the tools his company's been selling a lot lately to the oil and gas industry.
This is an air-driven gear multiplier. It loosens and tightens up threaded fasteners.
The company has grown from 2 employees to 8 at its Washington County shop. He said overall, Corbett's been good for his industry.
The fracking has increased our business threefold. You know, we've doubled, tripled in the last couple of years, and a lot of it has to do with this.
And that's why he'll vote for Corbett in 2014. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Center for Environmental Research and Education at Duquesne University. The center will host Facing the Challenges, a research symposium on shale gas extraction November 25th and 26th at Duquesne University. It's free and open to the public. Registration information for the conference can be found at duq.edu/shale. More information about the Center for Environmental Research and Education can be found at duq.edu/ESM.
This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Laura Legere has been covering the natural gas industry for several years. She won awards for her reporting at the Scranton Times Tribune, and she's recently gone solo as a freelancer. You'll find her byline frequently at State Impact, where she blogs about shale and energy issues. And she joins me now to talk about the latest shale news. Laura, good of you to check in.
Thanks so much for having me.
There's a lawsuit pending in federal court over a waste treatment plant in north central Pennsylvania in Warren County. Give me some background on the case. What does the plant treat and what's being alleged?
Well, the suit was filed by Clean Water Action, which is an environmental organization. And essentially, they are claiming that the plant actually doesn't have the right permit that would allow it to discharge oil and gas wastewater into the Allegheny River. The treatment plan is saying that that's just a misreading of its permit, that this was the permit that was requested of it by both federal and state regulators. And essentially what the argument here is that it's actually based on state findings that the water below the outfall of the treatment plant is saltier than the water above it. It has more metals in it, and there's accumulation of metals and radioactivity in the sediment of the stream bed there. So actually, state regulators went to study if this would have any effect on the aquatic life in the river, and they found that it did. So essentially, a lot of the case that Clean Water Action is making here is actually based on state regulators' findings. Now, Clean Water Action is arguing that the state hasn't moved quickly enough to do something about those problems. And actually, right before the suit was filed, the state did start some action. It told Waste Treatment Corp, the treatment plant, that it plans to pursue legal action. And then regulators are saying at this point that they're also working on a consent decree with the company to try to bring them into compliance to control some of these issues at the plant.
There's a lawsuit pending in federal court over a waste treatment plant in north central Pennsylvania in Warren County. Give me some background on the case. What does the plant treat and what's being alleged?
This was actually part of a large slate of changes in essentially shale drilling regulations. And what the state decided was that it really just doesn't have the manpower to have its inspectors go and look at every single existing well. I mean, there are tens of thousands of these wells across the state. And so instead what they decided to do was come up with a plan for the companies themselves to send their employees to look at these wells four times a year and then submit an annual report to the state. Well, that pretty much, there was an agreement on that early on that this was something that could be done. But when the state started designing the kind of forms that the companies would have to fill out, they realized that this was going to be quite a bit more effort. And then what the state is asking them to look for are things like visible signs of severe corrosion, really severe rusting that could cause a problem, or any signs of leaks of either fluids or gas, signs of excessive pressures in the well. So they're looking for sort of signs of things that could lead to bigger problems if they aren't stopped. And so the state then wanted to try to come up with a plan to make it so that if a company did see some of these problems, they would have some sort of concrete steps to take next to fix them. But this sort of spiraled into a much larger conversation about what the state had the authority to do and the cost that it would impose on these companies. So essentially, these 2 years, 2.5 years passed, and finally the state has decided to sort of trim the requirements to just exactly what's expected in the regulations, so that these companies can start going out to the wells this fall. And this will be the first, these few months before the end of the year, will be the first time the companies go out and actually perform these investigations. And the forced reports will actually be submitted to the state in February 2015.
Laura, thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That was Laura Legere. She reports for State Impact Pennsylvania, a partnership of WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, NPR News member stations. You're listening to the Allegheny Front. Pennsylvania's home to thousands of dams. Most were built during the early Industrial Revolution by settlers who needed a water supply. Later, larger dams were constructed for hydropower. But today, many of these stone and concrete barriers are being taken down. For most of the past decade, the Commonwealth has topped the list for the most dam removals in any state. In 2012, 13 dams were removed. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports on what the dam removals can mean for fish and waterways. Our story begins at the site of one recently removed dam.
The stream behind the old Westinghouse plant in Trafford near Pittsburgh used to look a lot more like a lake.
In fact, there was a piece of rope, and it made me wonder if people used it as a way to jump in, you know, like a rope swing.
That's Lisa Hollingsworth-Segedy. She's Associate Director for River Restoration with American Rivers. It's a national nonprofit. She advocates for dam removal across western PA and estimates there are 6,000 to 7,000 dams in the state. So it's a big job.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Today she's stopping by this section of Turtle Creek to check in on the site. It's a habit of hers whenever she's in the area. She's worked on dozens of dam removals, but Trafford is special to her. It was her first project with American Rivers and a hard-earned victory for the group last year.
As you can see, we cut the side over there, and we've taken the dam out, and now the stream flows through here.
Initially, the community was not entirely happy about the dam removal. To some, it meant the loss of a fishing spot and a swimming hole. Others say the concrete dam was a historical testament to the industrial past. It was built to provide water for Westinghouse Electric, which built fuses and fuse boxes here. The plant is now closed, partially torn down, and considered a brownfield site by the state. The dam was taken out in September. Now some local leaders, like Trafford Mayor Reynold Peduzzi, are excited that recovery of the stream's health will increase recreational tourism here, like canoeing. Hollingsworth-Segedy holds up a photo on her iPad to provide a side-by-side comparison. The before side shows the dam with a 12-foot pool of murky water behind it. She says that stagnant water would sit getting warm in the sun.
And with increased temperature, the dissolved oxygen starts to decline. And when the dissolved oxygen declines, it sets forth this whole chain of chemical changes.
Changes such as increased sediment and contamination. Those problems, combined with the urban environment, the stormwater, and abandoned mine drainage, have left Turtle Creek officially impaired, as classified by the Department of Environmental Protection. It's hard to believe, looking at the quickly running water today. Now that the dam is gone, it's a shallow, tumbling stream.
The single most important thing we can do for a stream to recover and for its water quality to improve is to remove the dam.
Hollingsworth-Segedy climbs down the steep bank to the water's edge. She says the water is cooler than it used to be, and they're already seeing new life.
Since the dam has been removed, I've seen black-nosed dace, those and a number of other little minnows coming up through this area. That's the first time I've ever seen fish here, so it was really encouraging.
The Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission is expected to visit the site in the next year to do formal fish surveys. Hollingsworth-Segedy expects dam removals to change and improve fishing. She's busy working to get other dams taken down and says the number in Pennsylvania is ticking lower year by year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
In the next several weeks on the Allegheny Front, we'll have much more on water issues. We'll visit nuns who are changing the landscape of their property to prevent flooding in their community. And we'll talk to an open water swimmer and hear her concerns about sewage contamination in the rivers.
Well, swimming or not swimming, I don't think anybody wants poop in their river. It's gross.
That's when our series, Ripple Effects, begins next week. I'm Jennifer Shveta-Jordan. This is the Allegheny Front. Sustainability. The word has been used so much, it's hard to say what it really means. Earlier this year in New York State's North Country, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited two dairy farmers. They work very differently, but they both described their brand of agriculture as sustainable.
The owner of one of the North Country's larger dairies thinks he has a little secret. Sandy Stauffer says small organic farms aren't sustainable.
People don't believe this, but it's true. It's probably less sustainable than what we have here.
What Stauffer and his son have is a 1,500-head farm that's in continuous milking mode.
Cows line up three times a day in the computerized milking parlor. Workers connect their udders to a machine, and the system knows exactly how much milk to expect from each cow. The dairy has 18 full-time employees, plus part-time seasonal labor.
To me, sustainability is all about supporting yourself and those who work for you, and also keeping the land in good condition for future generations. That's sustainability.
Stoffer says things are going pretty well at the farm these days. Over the past 10 years, they've grown considerably. They purchased a neighboring farm, added more than 1,000 cows, and built a new facility to house and milk them. When they're not hooked up to the milking machine, the cows are in an open-air barn. Stoffer wants every mouthful they eat to be exactly the same, with parts of corn, hay, and cottonseed. The herd also gets injections of recombinant bovine growth hormones, or RBST. 30-year-old Aaron Stoffer says it increases milk production by 10%.
It makes them a more efficient cow. Yes, they eat a little more and they poop a little more, but we will produce more milk with less feed and less poop by using BST.
The Stoffers say they use less land to produce more milk more efficiently than smaller farms, and that makes them a more sustainable operation. Organic farmer Bob Zufall agrees. Bigger farms are more efficient.
Yes, absolutely. But at what expense?
Zufall owns a 230-head farm in Lisbon. He questions whether modern efficiencies are good for dairy prices and the industry as a whole.
If you get so efficient that you make such a cheap price that you drive everybody out of business, what's gained there?
Zufall says milk prices barely meet most farm expenses now. Many farmers need government subsidies just to meet the cost of production, to grow and buy food for hormone injections, equipment, and large-scale facilities.
It's not sustainable. They can't do it without help.
Zufall keeps costs low. The green rolling hills dotted with munching cows look a lot like the picture on a Horizon organic milk container, which is where he sells his milk.
Once I'm done milking in the morning for 7 months out of the year, I put these cows outside, and I don't see them till the evening milking. I don't have to feed them. I don't have to clean up after them. You know, that's it. I my workload's lower, and of course my expenses. That's why I think I'm probably as sustainable as anybody.
Zufall doesn't have any expenses for feed. Hay doesn't cost him anything. His family doesn't produce as much milk as a farm like the Stoffers, but his organic grass-fed milk sells for more money, nearly a dollar more per gallon.
I try, but I'm not, I don't push myself or the cows, you know. I try, but I'm not out there to be number one and to be the guy with the most production. I want to be the guy that's there at the end of the day, still here, you know.
And that's a big part of what makes Bob Zufall's farm sustainable, by his definition. But Sandy Stoffer says it's not enough. He says the world needs the efficiency of farms like his. Stoffer tells me the population is growing and farms need to produce as much food as possible.
You would probably have to be out doing chickens or milking cows or something like that, because it would take that many more people to produce the amount of food that's needed for our population. And that's why farms have gotten large. That's why all of agriculture has gotten larger.
And that gets back to what Bob Zufall sees as the overproduction of milk at large, efficient farms. Zufall says lots of people would like to milk cows and raise chickens.
People want to do it, but they can't do it because it's so cheap. It has no value.
Zufall says the price of milk is so low, it's hard for many dairy farmers to make a living.
I keep hearing we got to feed the world. You know, we got to make all this food. There's plenty of food out there. Make it worthwhile doing, and you'll see more food than you could ever, ever want to see. Guarantee you.
Two farms, both doing well economically, but seeing what it takes to endure very differently. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from Table Magazine, sharing food, culture, and lifestyle in western Pennsylvania. The fall issue includes tailgating inspiration and tricks of the trade from three Italian chefs in Pittsburgh. Table Magazine's fall issue is on newsstands now. More information is available at tablemagazine.com.
One of the greatest challenges our climate has handed American farmers was, of course, the Dust Bowl. During Ag Progress Days in State College this year, Edward Buss was interviewed about growing up in the Dust Bowl. A tough time and place, the Midwest in the 1930s, it's part of WPSU's effort to collect stories about farm life. Buss spoke with Naomi Ulmer, an intern with the Pasto Agricultural Museum.
Since you were in Kansas, you would have experienced the Dust Bowl.
I went through the Dust Bowl. I lived through it, and I helped do the farming during those days when we had very little water. I had one 20-acre field of corn, and I cultivated with the old single row and my team of horses. On July the 4th in 1935, it was so hot that from the morning when the corn was beautiful green, at night there wasn't a stalk left.
Wow. So just the heat?
Just heat.
It withered it?
Just burnt. Mm-hmm. Another field, 20 acres of wheat, my father just put a match to because the chintz bugs had destroyed it. There was just nothing there to harvest. We got one cutting of hay. The ponds went dry. Mm-hmm. Our wells went dry. And so to find water was really difficult. In my case, the Republican River almost went dry. And we had grasshoppers. Every fence post was just nothing but grasshopper. Mm-hmm. You start walking, you just see thousands of them flying around. And then the chintz bugs were terrible, and they would go into our cornfields and destroy corn.
So there was a bug problem in addition to the drought?
Yes. Oh, my, yes. And then the Russian thistles we saw piling up in our fence rows and so on. And the dust was such that it was really, you could not keep it out of your house. Some people, you know, slept with wet claws over their faces.
How did you make it, how'd your family make it through if all your crops were dying? Like, how did you feed your animals?
Well, we pastured the cows in the wintertime on the wheat field. And then we had the hay, but we could save from the spring cutting. And then we cut some of our corn and just fed it directly to the cows. And then we always had silage. And in those days, it was so dry, they would plant two rows. In one row of the planter, you'd have corn, the other one you'd have sorghum. And there was enough moisture in the sorghum that helped provide moisture in the silage.
How many did you have?
Oh, I think we had, well, we milked about 10 to 12 all the time. We had whole stands.
Mm-hmm. So you milked them by hand?
Oh, yes. Okay. One leg stool, and put hobbles on some of the cows that like to kick.
I come from a dairy farm, so I'm very familiar with how ornery animals can be at times.
They were all different. And that's actually what got me into genetics, was just seeing the differences in the cows and the kind of calves they produced from year to year and the behavior of the cows.
Yeah.
Which one always broke the fence?
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, and I appreciated speaking with you.
You've asked good questions. Thank you.
Thanks to WPSU for that piece. It featured Edward Buss talking about his experience growing up during the Dust Bowl. He spoke with Naomi Ulmer, an intern with the Pasto Agricultural Museum. This piece was recorded at Ag Progress Days. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kara Holsoppel is the production and digital editor. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Jennifer Shveta Jordan. Join us again next time for more environmental news around your home on the Allegheny Front.
The Allegheny Front is supported by the Heinz Endowments and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of Marcellus Shale, energy, and conservation issues.